Welcome to the Catskill Review of Books, a weekly program interviewing authors, hosted by Ian Williams and produced by Kevin Greff in the hydro-powered studios of WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.
Hello, this is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and it gives me great pleasure to have back Robert Ferrigno, whose book, The Girl Who Cried Wolf, is a worthy successor to his series about the assassin, set in a sort of alternative America in which Islam is triumphant. Gripping series, well worth reading and going back to, because I presume he still gets royalties. But The Girl Who Cried Wolf is adventure, and it looks to me like you started off in alternative world, potentially alternative world, and then decided to sort of stick with the plot, as it were. Is that a fair assumption?
Well, what do you mean by an alternative world? You mean the world of the three would-be kidnappers?
Yes, yeah, so, you know, it looked to me like you'd started off science fictional dystopian element to it, and then you've merged it more back into the equally sordid reality of this particular time stream.
Well, you know, I think that's a really good perception. Because the dystopian vision of the world, I think, really does underlie a lot of the radical environmental movement, in which the world is seen as a filthy, dirty, dangerous place where, you know, plastic bags can kill you, and, you know, there's invisible something out there. So, but you're right. In a way, that is the classic dystopian vision. Where, and I think, you know, again, my whole point is there's a balance that when people get out of balance with any point of view, then you have the source of good fiction, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, it's not that you're sort of unhelpful, or should I say, unsympathetic to their dystopic point of view in terms of the damage and what's happened to the environment, but you do not approve of their reaction, their overreaction to it.
Exactly. That's. I mean, we all, none of us want to breathe sludge or smoke, but. You don't kidnap an heiress hoping to right the wrongs of the world. And I always do wonder, I mean, this, you know, you have to remember, I wrote this book about, you know, these three radical environmentalists who kidnap a rich woman and hoping to extort old growth timber from her rich father. And, you know, one of the environmentalists definitely has an agenda, a darker agenda, which he wants to, instead of taking the ransom for good purposes, supposedly, he basically wants to buy himself protection from the filth of the world by moving to some sort of clean place and having a mansion. And this was written before, you know, Al Gore sold his network to Al Jazeera, which is financed by the oil sheiks. So, you know, I think good fiction is always truer than the headlines, or at least ahead of the headlines. So,
Well, I like it because it seemed to have several parables in there, as it were. The idea that people of good motives, especially if they get sort of slightly unbalanced, are easily manipulable to do bad things by people of evil intent.
That's exactly right, and sometimes, you know, we reinforce each other with our unbalance, if you will. You know, where you get one guy who's a little bit nutty, and he, you know, manages to navigate through the world. But when that one nutty guy meets a couple of other nutty guys, they sort of reinforce each other, and then you've got real problems.
Now, the other part of the plot, which seems entirely plausible, because I've actually tweeted and written articles about it, is almost every terrorist plot that the FBI has thwarted in the last 5 years has been started by the FBI.
That's absolutely true. It's like a closed system where you create your customers. The law enforcement agencies create the criminals that they then can spend time and money busting and then patting themselves on the back. And any good defense attorney always argues, you know, there might not have been a crime if you hadn't encouraged these poor, desperate loners. You know, this, I think about a year ago, you know, you had an anarchist who was induced to blow up a bridge in Ohio filled with commuters, and, you know, it turned out, of course, his explosives were not real explosives, having been supplied by the FBI agent who was, let's say, encouraging him in his fantasies.
There's the use of the paid informants, people who actually are getting paid by results here, that's really disturbing.
That's right. If you don't actually get somebody to commit a crime, you don't get a bonus.
Yeah. This rings extremely true about your FBI agent, whose motivation is as much glory as money, of course, but it is almost FBI policy.
That's right. This is a character in the book named Cleo who is an FBI agent and wanting to move up the ladder, and at some point realizes, you know, it's better to go for the publicity even than official awards. I mean, in our culture, you know, Kim Kardashian has, you know, certainly a bigger income than the president, and we have a celebrity-driven culture, and someone like an FBI agent who, thwarted a terrorist plot, if they wanted to cash in on that, you know, they could do it on everybody from Oprah to the nightly news. So, and I do have a lot of fun with that. I mean, this book was actually started when I was in the middle of my trilogy, and the trilogy, you know, which I'm very proud of, involved a lot of research, and the research was profoundly depressing, you know, which is the political state of the world, and particularly the Middle East. And I needed something to give me some laughs, and The Girl Who Cried Wolf was intentionally written to make me smile, so and hopefully smile before by telling a good story.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I also got the impression, it's certainly not a put-down because he's one of my favorite authors, but you've done for Cascadia what Carl Hiaasen did for Florida.
Yeah. Yes, that's very true.
We should tell the listeners that the novel is set in the forests, the West Coast forests along from Seattle, rain and all.
which is where I live, and a lot of the people in the book, a lot of the characters in the book are intentionally close to truth as I can get it. The Pacific Northwest, Portlandia is not necessarily considered fiction.
Mm. In fact, by an amazing coincidence, our last program was with Phil Campbell, who I thought it was a novel until he contradicted me afterwards. It's a memoir of his time running a campaign for Seattle City Council at the time of 9/11. And
that's right.
It really did invoke a lot of the same elements that you've got in your novels. There must be something about the damp up there.
There's let's just say that we grow a lot of strange creatures here. I think, you know, in Seattle, you basically stay inside a lot and you talk, which is why coffee plays such a big part in Seattle culture, because it'd be better to be inside drinking a cup of coffee and talking with your chums than wandering through the slush and the freezing cold.
That's al fresco is al adobe. It's in the mud.
That's exactly.
One of the things that I liked about both your assassin trilogy is that you have very strong women characters. I'm wondering if this is based upon your personal experience. Even the villainesses have a joie de vivre and an ability to enjoy themselves that's quite refreshing.
It's absolutely the strong female character runs through all of my books and is definitely drawn from real life. I usually describe my books as involving smart, tough guys who run into smarter and tougher women, and fun ensues. And I'm a a great observer of the human condition, which is usually that men think they're running the world, but in fact there's usually a woman by their side who's directing things.
This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and this week I'm talking to Robert Ferrigno, author of the Assassin Trilogy, which we covered a year or so ago, and currently author of The Girl Who Cried Wolf. Now, the strength of character here, you based this on the O. Henry story, there was a Red Chief, where the
Ransom of Red Chief, yeah.
Yes, which I remember well. I mean, O. Henry is one of my favourite authors, and I'm surprised he's not mined more often for brilliant, succinct story plots. In fact, I think the whole short story is undervalued, but that's a separate story.
It's true.
A short story as well. But did you have that idea before you put a female character, the female character as the basically as the Red Chief substitute, or did you sort of pick on the female character and then work backwards to the O. Henry?
I worked backwards. I sort of would reverse engineered it, if you will, and often, you know, I don't intentionally put those strong female characters as the sort of motivating force for the action, but it always seems to be I end up there. I mean, I really thought this was going to be a real guy book, you know, three guys kidnapping this seemingly helpless rich girl who, you know, clearly turns out to be infinitely smarter and resourceful than they think. But there's always, you know, these are the roots of fiction. You know, there's undoubtedly something in my psyche that says, you know, what would make this even better is if there's a bad girl, and the bad girl usually emerges.
Mm-hmm. But obviously you like bad girls.
Absolutely.
Both in this Cleo and your sort of villainess in the Assassin Trilogy, you have quite charming and delightful, and you get the feeling that you'd like to meet them, even if you'd wear a sort of protector on your crotch if you did.
Yeah, I would love to meet them, and I would also know I wouldn't stand a chance against them. So I'm sure there's the playing the part of the divine victim is must be somewhere in my heart. But yeah, I can't stop writing about bad girls, and I try to make them each a little bit different. And but you're right, in the Assassin Trilogy, to me the one of the very strongest characters is Baby, who is runs through the whole three books and at the end is strangely triumphant. And in fact, the emails I get from readers on that trilogy often ask me, "What's Baby up to these days?" And I take that as high praise, because I think she's still alive and doing very well myself. So.
God knows what she'd be up to. The world's most unlikely Islamic fundamentalist plotter, I would say.
Exactly. So good that you'd never know it.
Yes. So, I mean, the other aspect of this is your other books were actually handsomely produced in hardback with very distinctive covers, and this one has gone straight into an e-book. Is this a commercial decision, or did the publishers fail to recognize its manifest merits, which I can testify having read it, or did you just decide that this was the way of the future and the way that you can make more money without publishers interfering in the business?
It was an experiment on my part and my agent's part. He had actually dissuaded me when I first talked to him about this as I was working on it a couple years ago. I design video games, and so I'm very involved with technology and digital transmission of information. And I said, I really think this is where books are going, you know, and there's something really elegant to me about an e-book that you can transmit, and people can you know, link to, and he said, oh, I don't think that's a good idea. You know, there's still a cachet to, you know, hardback publication. But by the time I was ready for the book, he had set up a whole ebook part of his business and said, if you're game, let's try it. And, you know, if it works, if it doesn't, I'm working on another book now. And if the ebook doesn't work, then we'll go the traditional route. But I find it exciting, the possibilities of it. And because, I mean, I design video games that you can play on a tablet, and the same tablet that you can read books on. And so there's something really elegant to me about it. I hope it works. I mean, I have a library full of, quote, real books, unquote.
They're great insulation in the cold north. my farmhouse has walls lined with them. It's my excuse for buying more.
I don't think physical books will ever go away, but I think increasingly we are going to a digital model. I mean, I see it in video games. The video games that you buy in the store, they're shrinking in terms of the market, and yet people are buying downloadable video games. So, in a way, you know, I think in the future we could all be naked and have full libraries full of entertainment and intellectual stimulation, but it would be in a cloud. You know, it's invisible, and I mean, it is sci-fi, but I think that's where we're moving.
Mm-hmm. Well, amongst many of our listeners are aspirant authors, actual or aspirant authors themselves, I've discovered, and so they're always interested in the minutiae. How does this shake down professionally, and, well, in two ways, I suppose, both in terms of cachet. It's okay for you because you've already got several successful hardbacks under your belt and on your escutcheon, as it were, so you can afford to publish an ebook, but does publishing as an ebook sort of have the same pejorative sense of doing a vanity self-published book did a few years ago, or has it got past beyond that?
I think that's a really good question, and you're right. I can, in a way, I can get away with it because I've had, you know, this is my 12th book. I had 11 hardback originals, you know, and foreign sales, et cetera. And so that kind of gets away from the, oh, you printed your own book kind of a thing. But ultimately, I mean, the marketplace prevails, and there's been plenty of people who, you know, had no publishing experience, whose first book was an ebook. And the book became very successful, and, you know, sometimes hardback publishers at that point swoop in and say, oh, you know, we must have overlooked you before, but now that you've proven yourself on your own, maybe we'd like to publish you.
Come and exploit you, the grasping capitalist swine that they are.
So it was sort of like they blame it on, you know, they'll blame it on some low-level functionary. Anyone could have seen it was a brilliant piece of fiction. But
it never got past the slush pile, and we fired that intern long ago.
I really think that the publishers are very nervous about self-publishing or people taking that kind of control, because the reality is, I mean, The Girl Who Cried Wolf has a fine cover, which, you know, there's now a whole industry of really good designers out there who will design ebook covers for you for relatively inexpensive prices. There's marketing firms, there's editing services. I mean, everything that the publishers did, people can do on their own now. And you know, it's pure capitalism. You are taking the risk, but at the same time, even when I sell, when all my books are available for download online, the people who, you know, whether, let's say it's Amazon, they get 30%, I get 70%. When a hardback publisher takes on my work, I get 15%, not 70. So if your book is successful, then you're a genius. And if your book fails, then you've got a tax write-off.
I mean, it does not entail as much capital up front as printing 10,000 hardbacks and getting edited. But, I mean, I've never understood. As capitalists, publishers in this country are, well, lackadaisical.
You know, if I have had, you know, great experiences with publishers, and I've had horrible experiences with publishers, and I've always been involved in the marketing of my books, whether it was, you know, whether I was at Random House or you know, wherever, and so that part of the business was relative. I was comfortable with that. You know, I have you know, people who've supported my books in the past and helped promote my books, and they're still out there. I mean, that's why I'm talking to you. because you and I have talked before. We had a good time on the phone, and you like my books, and you know, it's. I mean, the tricky part is breaking in, and I was fortunate enough. You know, that's where the backstory of having 11 previous novels certainly helps. But I always encourage people to, you know, I'm a gambler. I always say bet on yourself, and that's what, you know, that's what self-publishing can be.
Yeah, and I should point out the serendipitiness of this. The first time I read your trilogy, I stumbled on one of them by accident in a second-hand store.
Yep.
And then I bought the others and called you. It was not the publisher's marketing department.
Oh, no. Never count on the publishers to do the right thing, or the, you know, they're too busy, or they're too clueless. No, it's I place great value on serendipity. I mean, you know, when you think of the sperm and the egg, we exist only through the most random of circumstances. So. Which is great. I mean, like I say, I'm a gambler, and we have all won life's lottery just by being alive. So, you know, let's see what comes next.
Mm-hmm. This is Ian Williams with the Catskill Review of Books, and I'm talking to Robert Farinio about his book, The Girl Who Cried Wolf, and with references back to his previous Assassin trilogy, all of which are available on download. And but uniquely, is this one going to appear in, you know, sort of traditional wood pulp form at some point?
It will probably appear at least in various foreign editions. If it does well in the ebook format, I'm sure my agent will consider that. But I mean, we're really in new territory at this point. Like I say, the foreign markets, book markets, continue to be good and have been good to me. And in fact, in the last 6 weeks, I just sold the Assassin trilogy to a German firm and a French firm. So you know, it's, you know, the book world is nice, because just when you think something's over, somebody else discovers you, and you know. Who knows? Somebody in France must have, you know, talked to somebody at a party, and the next thing you know, there's a sale. So, and I don't think in Europe, at least, there's that much of a difference between e-books, you know, in terms of cachet, between the e-books and a harder paperback, since most European editions are paperback to begin with, and there was a time paperback originals were looked down upon in the States. So, you know, I think when it comes down to it, it's all about the reading experience, and if you have an author who can take you someplace and entertain you and educate you, it doesn't matter the way you get the information, whether it's on an ebook reader or a nice leather bound edition, or in a paperback that you can fold in half as you're on the subway. You know, it's all about where does the writer take you.
Oh, it makes a huge difference what you're reading. I read books in Victorian yellowed wood pulp issues disintegrating in my hands, and when I reread them again in a folio leather-bound edition, it was almost a different experience.
Right.
But especially, as you mentioned, with paperbacks, because American publishers, until the advent of the trade paperback, they almost, well, I think they deliberately made the paperback to disintegrate after one or two readings.
They did. It was a planned obsolescence so that you couldn't pass it on to too many people.
So, yes, so the, to preserve the hardback sales.
that's right. But you know, like I say, there was a time when paperbacks were looked down upon, and that certainly has changed. And I suspect we're in the middle of a period in which an ebook original will not be seen of as a compromise.
So you mentioned you have another one hovering around in your creative horizon. Any hints about, are you continuing this? Is it taking up with Baby where she left off? Or?
Well, this one is going to be a contemporary thriller with a religious theme, in the same way that the Assassin trilogy was had a religious theme, was a thriller with a religious theme, but this one is contemporary. I kind of learned my lesson. When you set a book in the future, you have to spend huge amounts of time and energy populating the world so that you know what's the same and what's different. When you write a contemporary thriller, you know, the reader supplies the architecture just by the reading, you know, just by their knowledge base. So I'm going to write it. It's a contemporary thriller. It's it has a very, very big theme to it, and it'll probably take me another year and a half to finish. I like to get it right, so I don't write too fast.
Oh, so I was about to say, how do you perfect your work? Do you do it slowly and polish every facet, or do you rush through it and then come back and reshape it, Jackson Pollock style?
I'm a guy who I get up very early. I usually get up at 4, start writing by about 4:30, and work for a few hours, and I do that every day. When I start the day, I always start by reading what I wrote the day before and just sort of fine-tuning it and then move forward, so that there's always a process, so that by the time I'm done, it's basically already probably a second or third draft, and then I'll go back and rewrite the whole thing. But I always like to have forward motion. I don't like to... in my first novel, I think I spent 2 years on the first 50 pages, and they were a great 50 pages, but at a certain point, you have to get past that and, you know, embrace the fact that it won't be perfect until you rewrite it a few more times. But it's really good to get that first draft done.
Yes, but you started with word processors. You weren't in the days when you actually had to throw away the typing.
You know, when I was in grad school, I used a typewriter, I embraced a word processor as soon as they were available. I think I had one of the first computers when they first came out.
Yeah, ditto. It was a revelation. I even had an electric typewriter. Look, Robert, this is all we have time for. As previously, it's been fun talking to you. I really enjoyed your book, which, for the benefit of listeners, is The Girl Who Cried Wolf. Heartily recommended, out February the 19th this week, a few days ago. And just go and buy it. Enjoy. And look up his Assassin trilogy as well. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
Listen in next week to the Catskill Review of Books from WJFF in Jeffersonville, New York.